The other quite interesting and quite under-recognised influence on Malthus was Thomas Jefferson. So Thomas Jefferson wrote a very important text called Notes on the State of Virginia, and in it, that is very well known, and it sits there in Malthus's library in Jesus College in Cambridge. We know that he used it, and it is essentially an intricate audit of land, everything about Virginia. Land in Virginia, rivers in Virginia, what was grown in Virginia, but also extensive information down to the level of numbers of individual people of Native Americans in the state of Virginia, in the colony of Virginia at that point. And so we know that Malthus had read this very, very detailed audit of the number of Native Americans in Virginia. So he was quite schooled in what all colonial Americans knew, which was this was a major problem and what was to be done.
Book one, chapter
Even
one.
If the United States of America was almost entirely vegetable, where is the fresh land?
If America continues increasing, which it certainly will do, then the Indians will be driven further and further back into the country until the whole race is ultimately exterminated.
In 1803, when Malthus was producing this essay, it just so happens that Thomas Jefferson, of course later the president, was already thinking over the possibility of removing Native Americans over the other side of the Mississippi River as possibly the most desirable way forward to essentially clear land. And that this would be the best for the Native Americans themselves. And this of course, is implemented in the 1830 Indian Removal Act, what comes to us as the very famous Trail of Tears. And I think it's often not quite recognised that these events are the life and times of Malthus, not just the French Revolution, the so-called Industrial Revolution, the Poor Law, the Corn Law, everything that's going on in Britain. This is also the period when, in colonial America, about which Malthus was very well read and thought quite a bit on, that the likes of Jefferson, who he read, are thinking through, and later it's actually President Andrew Jackson who implements the Indian Removal Act, the removal of people, what Malthus called in 1803 driving the natives into a corner. So these kinds of colonial ventures were implemented over Malthus's lifetime.
The whole earth, in this respect, is like an island.
When I came back to read Malthus in a what I think of now as almost a spatial way, I found space everywhere in his essays. So he talks about he's very, very interested in actual islands. That's why he writes about the South Sea Islands. He writes about New Zealand, in fact, extensively. So he's interested in actual islands and how, when people who don't, when communities, populations can't expand, how is the population kept down? So when there is literally no possibility of extending area, extending land, what happens? But this does become almost a metaphor for him. So he writes at some point in his chapter on North America that besieged Indians, he said, we should think of also as islanders, that they are limited in space, that they only have so much room in which to grow food, and that therefore impacts on life and death. But even more amazingly for me, he writes at one point, he says the whole earth is like an island. And he says even if every inch of the earth is to become vegetable, by which he means if every inch of the earth is cultivated, where then is fresh land to turn up? In other words, we are on ultimately a limited island space. And it's fascinating to me, actually, that he so early imagines the globe as a whole, as an island, as a limited space. in that he's also drawing from Benjamin Franklin, who, in an extraordinary passage that we know Malthus read, Benjamin Franklin talks about what the Earth would look like from Mars. So there is a line coming through this Malthusian literature that comes right down to us, actually, in 20th century global ecology and so forth, well before Sputnik or the Earthrise photographs and all that kind of stuff that happens, you know, in the, to me, much less interesting later 20th century. They're quite able, Malthus and Benjamin Franklin are quite able to imagine in their heads and write about a singular, closed, limited globe in space. Who did he influence? He started a whole discussion about what are the real numbers going on here. So how many people are there? So the very important 1801 census, which is, you know, one of the first really thorough census in Britain, is sparked by the 1798 essay. So he was quite influential on the people who are implementing things like the poor laws in Britain. He was quite influential on welfare discussion at the time. His opposition to the poor law was something that was taken very seriously. He was fairly influential at the time on economic policies about, you know, the corn laws and the whole question of the importation and taxes on corn. So his economic theories were in the early 19th century fairly influential, later less so. But there's another line of influence that is more, if I can put it this way, more the sex than the food element of Malthus, which for him were always two sides of the same coin, always a population and a resource, a food and a sex issue. For Malthus himself, there were limits on the ways in which human populations could be restrained, could be kept down in terms of reproduction. He was famously opposed to any form of technological or reproductive contraception. Mm. He was opposed to any practice at all whereby conception would be deliberately limited. Except for, and this comes up in his later editions, he changes his mind a bit, except for the whole set of customs about when one marries. So one way, he said, in which populations could be more easily kept down is if people married later in life. So if men in particular only married once they had, you know, very clear means to be able to raise a family. So his argument was that not in any sense for contraception, but that delaying marriage was an entirely legitimate and in some ways a very worthwhile thing to do. His influence by about the 1820s was in opposition to that. So many of the people in the 1820s and 30s picked up Malthus and said, yes, of course, populations should be limited and people should only reproduce actually if they have the means to feed and raise those children. But we disagree with the Malthus's delaying marriage technique. That is, they said, unhealthy, impractical and highly undesirable for umpteen ways. That, in fact, what we need to do is advocate and disseminate information about effective means of contraception. And that begins the very influential line of what is called neo-Malthusianism. And the neo-Malthusians are never, they're always a marginal group, but they gather pace over the 19th century. They never really lose the economics of Malthus's original ideas. Neo-Malthusians in the 19th century always had a sense of their mission as a means by which poverty would be minimised. But the means by which that could be implemented was through disseminating essentially contraceptive techniques. And that's the kind of birth control lobbying that by the early 20th century we receive in Malthusians like Margaret Sanger, for example, the famous US birth control lobbyist. But it's also something that was famously picked up and argued by really, really key political economists in the 19th century like John Stuart Mill, for example. So by the 1880s, there are in Britain, they call themselves the Malthusian League, and they gather up very quickly all of these key authorising figures like John Stuart Mill as their own. And in terms of a diversity of influences, Malthus is quite extraordinary over the 19th and 20th century, and in some ways I think it's because the population question touches, really, it touches almost everything. It touches questions of land, it touches questions of human reproduction, it touches the questions of economic value and labour, it turns into a line of thinking about ecology and closed spaces and the way in which or whether economies and ecologies can in fact expand or whether they are limited. So there's a scope and a reach about the population question in particular that when we go back to read Malthus we can still find.
Narrative of the surveying voyages of His Majesty's ships Adventure and Beagle.
In New South Wales,
as the white man has travelled onwards, he has spread over the country belonging to several tribes. Charles Darwin, London, 1839.
The other really key influence of Thomas Robert Malthus was on Darwin. And very famously, Darwin, who had been very carefully gathering his data for decades, not quite knowing what it all added up to, as he says in his autobiography, picked up Malthus one day to reread it, the essay on the principle of population, and suddenly had a lightning moment where it all fell into place. And that was a section of the essay on the principle of population where Malthus talks about the struggle for room and food, where Malthus says, too many organisms are always born for the number that can survive. Some will always die. That's Malthus. And in fact, Malthus gets that from Benjamin Franklin, oddly enough. And so one very important 19th century influence of Malthus was on this sparking moment, as Darwin always wrote about it, this moment of clarity in reading Malthus, where he suddenly saw what turned out to be, what he wrote as, his theory of evolution by natural selection.
30 years is a short period in which to have banished the last Aboriginal from his native island, and that island nearly as large as Ireland. I do not know a more striking instance of the comparative rate of increase of a civilized over a savage people.
In some ways, because I'm a colonial historian, I sat back and thought, well, what else is actually going on in 1803? The Louisiana Purchase, this incredible move in North America whereby the French sold vast amounts of the North American continent to the new United States is one thing that's going on.
Not a living person was to be found in the bays and harbours that were, before the pox, the most frequented. Not a vestige of a human foot was to be traced on the sands. They had left the dead to bury the dead. The excavations in the rocks were filled by putrid bodies, and in many places the paths were covered with skeletons.
In 1830, when Malthus produced his summary of the essay, I also asked what else is going on. This is the year of the Indian Removal Act. This is the year also of what Australian historians know as the Black Line, the year in which Aboriginal people were, the intention was for Aboriginal people to be rounded up, as it were, in Tasmania and pressed down, taken down into the peninsula and thereafter onto reservations, essentially to clear land for cultivation in Van Diemen's Land. And so now that I've become much more aware of the extent to which Malthus wrote about New South Wales, the extent to which, and his opinions on the clearing of, as it were, of native occupants, it seems to be me to be not inconsequential that things like the Indian Removal Act, the Trail of Tears, and Tasmania's Black Line happened all within his lifetime. And that's the context, that's the colonial, what I've come to call the New World context, as it were, as a shorthand, in which we might have another think about the essay and about Malthus himself.
The process of improving their minds and directing their industry would necessarily be slow. To exterminate the inhabitants of the greatest part of Asia and Africa is a thought that could not be admitted for a moment. To civilize and direct the industry of the various tribes of Tartars and Negroes would certainly be a work of considerable time and of variable and uncertain success.
And it's nonsense to write about him as some archetypal anti-colonialist, but I have to say what I really want to stress is what Malthus knows he needs to deal with is the question of people already there. And that generation were automatically and necessarily aware of the presence of and even the ownership of Indigenous people in New World lands in a way that later historians themselves don't necessarily take seriously or don't necessarily take into account. So I've become quite interested in the way in which, you know, a lot of economic historians will write about ghost, what they often call the ghost acres, the land that is over there, you know, the extra land in the New World. So they're aware of its economic significance, but they don't necessarily take seriously what Malthus himself took seriously, which was this deep problem about people whose land it already was.
The whole earth, in this respect, is like an island.
Malthus and the New World was produced by Michelle Rayner, with technical production from Dave Manton. Professor Alison Bashford is from the University of Sydney. Her forthcoming book, Geopolitics and the World Population Problem, Life and Earth in the Global 20th Century, is published by Columbia University Press. Readings in today's program were by Humphrey Bauer and John O'May.